Welcome to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a weekly roundtable discussion of events and issues facing the church and culture today. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Diocese of Colorado Springs and the Catholic Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Welcome, friends. This is Bishop Michael Sheridan. Thanks for joining us on today's program. And I certainly want to begin by wishing all of you a very blessed Christmas season, praying that God will give you all the graces and blessings of this holy season. On today's program, we're going to be discussing something very, very important, very urgent these days, not just for Catholics, but in a particular way for Catholics, and that is religious liberty, freedom of religion. It's something I think we Americans, for the most part, take for granted. It's enshrined in our Constitution. It has played an important part in the history of our country. Freedom of religion, for the practice of religion, freedom to make the voices of religious people able to have those voices heard, not just within their own churches, but even in the public square. The reason we're talking about religious liberty today is because it is sadly under assault now in our country, especially with regard to the Catholic Church, but as I think we'll find out, not exclusively for Catholics. Our guests today are first Bishop William Laurie. Bishop Laurie is the Bishop of Bridgeport, Connecticut. And Bishop Laurie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Bishop Sheridan, nice to be with you.
Well, great. And Bishop Laurie is the chairman of the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops Ad Hoc Committee on Religious Liberty. This is a brand new committee formed and approved by the bishops of the United States. We'll find out why very shortly, and also find out why Bishop Laurie was asked to head up this committee. An excellent choice. His name was not drawn out of a hat. There was a good reason for asking Bishop Laurie to do this. Also with us today is Martin Nussbaum. Martin Nussbaum is an attorney, and he is our attorney, in fact, here in the Diocese of Colorado Springs, but has also assisted bishops and dioceses around the country, especially with issues that have to do with religious liberty. Martin is kind of an expert in that area, and also now serves as a consultant to Bishop Laurie's Ad Hoc Committee on Religious Liberty. So welcome to you, Martin.
Bishop, thank you. It's good to be with you and with Bishop Laurie.
Well, very good. Now, Bishop Laurie, let's start with you. And when I said there was good reason for you to be heading up this Ad Hoc Committee on Religious Liberty, it was because you had to deal with this in a very significant way in your own Diocese of Bridgeport, correct?
It's true. I guess I am a little bit battle-tested, one might say. Back in 2009, in the Judiciary Committee of the State Assembly, the legislature, there was raised a bill that would have reorganized Roman Catholic parishes. It was targeted only at the Catholic Church, and they would have reorganized our parishes along the lines of a congregational church, taking administrative control of our parishes away from the pastor, away from the bishop, and giving it to an elected committee. And together with the other bishops in Connecticut, we had a very urgent task of mobilizing Catholics and defeating that legislation, not letting it go forward. And that was really done in the space of a weekend. And within a week of that bill's having been raised, we had a rally of almost 5,000 people on the steps of the Capitol in Hartford, Connecticut. The bill did not proceed, of course. Many very fine experts came and testified against it, and the bill went away. So it's really astonishing to think that a state government could imagine that it could exercise that much control over the internal affairs of a particular church or of any church. And I believe that really alerted myself and a lot of people to the palpable present dangers against religious liberty.
And Bishop Laurie and Martin, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that this is just an unheard-of intrusion of the government into the life of a church. Would you say so, Martin?
Well, it's an unacceptable intrusion. It's interesting that event is actually an echo of what was called the trusteeship controversy. So from about the 1780s through the 1880s, about a 100-year period, there were many state legislatures that wanted to separate the governance of parishes from bishops and pastors.
Well, that's true. No, you're right.
And it was a terrible thing, and it was really part of the Catholics were a minority culture, and there was concern that bishops were unreliable, so many state legislatures tried to do something like this before. What was amazing in 2009 is that a legislature hadn't learned the lesson. I mean, that this issue had been resolved a long time ago, that if there's any freedom the church ought to enjoy is the freedom to govern itself in accordance with its own structures, and that's why we have diverse structures of churches in the United States.
Well, congratulations to you, Bishop Laurie, the other bishops of Connecticut, and those who assisted you in this. It was an important decision, and it was because of your experience there that Archbishop Dolan, who's the president of the Conference of Catholic Bishops here in the United States, asked you to head up this ad hoc committee on religious liberty. Would you want to talk a little bit about the genesis of that? I think you and I and Martin as well pretty well know that, but our listeners would be interested in how that came about.
Thank you, Bishop Sheridan. I believe that those who are observing both law and culture have noted the erosion of religious liberty over time, but in recent times, that erosion has accelerated. There have been some very specific threats to religious liberty that have arisen just in the last several years. And so as these threats to religious liberty at the state and federal level began to mount, it attracted the attention of bishops all over the country. It attracted the attention as well of diocesan attorneys. And so in our meeting in Seattle of the bishops back in June of this year, we decided, after a very fine presentation from Anthony Pecorello, our general counsel, that religious liberty ought to be one of the main driving priorities of the Conference of Catholic Bishops. It was really resounding what the bishop said. Archbishop Dolan, who's a very perceptive leader, went to work on the subject over the summer, came up with the idea of creating an ad hoc committee, and got it approved at the administrative board in September of this year. And really by November, it was up and running. He asked me to be the chair of it, just as Hurricane Irene was bearing down on Connecticut. And I thought that was sort of appropriate and got a kick out of it. And when I agreed to it, to tell you the honest truth, I didn't realize it would be quite the project that it is. But I'm delighted to be a part of it. I've managed to field an excellent team of bishops and lay consultants. And we are hard at work as we speak.
Well, I am delighted, as I know the other bishops are delighted, that you accepted that invitation from Archbishop Dolan. And I know you've really just gotten started. You had, I think, your initial meeting in November. I don't know if you've met since then, but how would you describe, I guess you'd say, the goal? What does the committee, this ad hoc committee on religious liberty, what do you see as your agenda, your main purpose or purposes for existing? And Martin, feel free to jump in on that also.
Well, thank you. I'd say we have both long-term and short-term goals. Long-term is certainly to affect the culture. Our American culture has seen a sort of an eclipse in the appreciation of religious liberty as the first of our liberties and as fundamental to the rest of our liberties, with an overarching, aggressive, godless secularism asserting itself in our culture. But I would also say that we have some immediate threats to religious liberty that could affect the ability of the church to fulfill its mission. And so I think the ad hoc committee is already hard at work, focused on addressing those threats to religious liberty, which I'm sure we'll be talking about a little later on in our program. And so we've basically divided our tasks into one of education and public awareness, litigation, also public policy, and also scholarship, because it's important that religious liberty retain its full appreciation and its pride of place among scholars of the Constitution, history, and the humanities. So that's a kind of a snapshot of the work of the committee. We have met in Baltimore back in November, but we just recently met by teleconference in the last day or two.
So that's a big agenda, and I'd like to comment just a little bit about the first thing Bishop Lori said, which is that one of the goals of the committee is to affect the culture itself. And one of the things we know about freedom is that if we don't each of us steward it in our time, we're going to lose it. And Catholic Americans are particularly well situated to do this, because we know something both as Catholics and as Americans about this freedom. So really the most distinctive thing about the United States experiment is that we have disestablished religion in the United States for the first time from the era of Constantine. A Western government did that. So we have a different experience vis-a-vis church and state in the United States, and Americans learned about that, and American Catholics learned about that, and through the work of John Courtney Murray and others, the bishops in Rome and the Second Vatican Council began to articulate somewhat differently its view about religious freedom in a very important document called Dignitatis Humani, or the Declaration on Religious Freedom. And so the insight that American Catholics came to informed the larger church that the reason religious freedom matters is because the most distinctive thing about us as human beings is we have consciences. We in some ways, as Athanasius said, participate in the reasonableness or the mind of God. And it's precisely because of that that makes us human, and also means we need to protect that freedom. And so that's a big project to help Catholics understand that. And if I may say one thing more about this, one of the things we're seeing by the opponents to religious liberty is they're invoking the anti-discrimination principle, especially with regard to sexual mores, now that we're seeing sexual orientation included as a protected class, against religion itself. And our culture and our law used to recognize readily that when that happens, the religious freedom value would trump the anti-discrimination value. So in Title VII, the Civil Rights Act, there was a exception to the rule you can't discriminate on the basis of religion, saying churches, of course, can. And what we're seeing now is that the culture understands the anti-discrimination principle, and they think it ought to trump the religious freedom principle. Exactly. And it should be the other way around.
That's right. We're going to continue this discussion with Bishop William Laurie and Martin Nussbaum in just a moment. So stay with us, and we'll be back after this short break.
The Colorado Catholic Herald's blog offers a chance for you to be heard on Catholic issues. Click on the red blog link at coloradocatholicherald.com and join the discussion. The Colorado Catholic Herald, bringing the Catholic world to you.
Today's episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents is archived at Colorado Catholic Herald online. Just go to www.coloradocatholicherald.com and click on the audio-video link on the left side, and you can listen to every episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents.
Welcome back. This is Bishop Sheridan. We're continuing our discussion today on the very important topic of religious liberty, and in particular, recent assaults on religious liberty in our country. Religious liberty is something we have valued as Americans and as religious people throughout the history of our country, but it's fallen on some hard times recently, and with us is Bishop William Laurie. Bishop Laurie is the Bishop of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and heads up our national conference, our United States Conference of Catholic Bishops ad hoc committee on religious liberty. The bishops of the United States have seen this as a particularly important thing to take on and consider. And also, Mr. Martin Nussbaum, an attorney, the attorney for the Diocese of Colorado Springs, but also a consultant to Bishop Laurie's ad hoc committee. Welcome back to both of you, and thanks again for being with us. In our first segment, we talked somewhat generally about the genesis of this ad hoc committee and what's going on now in erosion of religious liberty in our country. Now would be a good time. Let's mention some of the particular things that have brought this to our attention. Maybe we could start. We'll have both of you, Bishop Laurie and Martin, feel free to take this on. And that is the Department of Health and Human Services recent decision, which I'm presuming is final. I don't know if there'll be any changes to that. That now all entities, including most church entities, are going to have to include in their insurance coverage of their employees contraceptives which could be abortifacients, correct?
And yes. Yes, they're mandating pretty much across the board that insurers would have to include abortifacients or drugs that can cause an abortion, sterilization, and also contraception in their plans. Now, there is a religious exemption, but it is very, very narrow, and it would basically say that you can be exempt from this if your organization employs mostly only, let's say in our case, Catholics, that it serves mostly Catholics, and if the purpose of the organization is only to inculcate the faith, well, the Catholic Church employs an awful lot of Catholics, but we also have some very valued co-workers who are not Catholic. We certainly exist to proclaim and teach the faith, but we also have a mission that is broader than that. And furthermore, we serve not only Catholics, we serve people in need of all faiths and none. And so what's happening is HHS, Health and Human Services, is really defining for us a very narrow mission. In other words, they are not only, what they are basically doing is constricting our mission. They're saying you can follow your conscience, with regard to abortifacients, contraception, sterilization, so long as you fit our governmental definition of what your mission is. And here it is, and it's a very narrow one. In fact, it's so narrow that Sister Carol Keehan of the Catholic Health Association said that it just about covers the parish housekeeper. So it's incredible. Now, this rule, as I understand it, and Martin, you're more of an expert than I would be on this, it's something called an interim final rule. I suppose that's a combination of words you'd only find in Washington, D.C., but it's a rule that it's under review. HHS has been flooded with comments from people objecting to this rule, as many as 200,000 comments, I'm told, and there is some promise that they would broaden the religious exemption, but it remains to be seen if what they will come out with will be truly adequate to cover all religious employers and insurance plans, and if they will also be willing to accommodate the rights of individual employers who have conscience objections to providing for abortifacients, sterilization, and contraception.
And Martin, before you comment on this, let's be very clear for our listeners. As Bishop Laurie has spoken about this very, very narrowly defined religious exemption, for us in the Catholic Church, for example, this religious exemption would not apply to schools, I would not think. It would not apply to Catholic hospitals. It would not apply to Catholic charities, because in all those cases, not only are some of the employees not Catholic, those who are served, some are not Catholic.
Bishop, the exemption is teeny tiny. It is so narrow that some have correctly said it wouldn't apply to Jesus and his apostles, because they were always reaching out to folks who weren't Christian. That's what evangelism is about. And when you're serving people who aren't already in your group, it'll disqualify you from the exemption. So we have an extremely broad rule and a teeny tiny exemption. And the breadth of the rule, this rule is being promulgated by Secretary Sebelius under HHS as part of the implementation of the Affordable Health Care Act, which is known popularly as Obamacare. And the listeners need to understand what Bishop Laurie just said. It's called the HHS contraceptive mandate, but the definition of pregnancy has been changed by the FDA so that contraceptives now include, or with a definition of contraceptives, include abortifacients. So essentially, it's requiring not only employers, not only, but church employers and faith-based organization employers, Christian colleges who provide health benefits for their students, hospitals and others, and to provide abortifacients and contraceptives for their employees and their students. It also applies to insurers. So even if you fit within the exemption, the insurers are governed by it. So it's not clear under this rule if there were a religious insurer, which there are precious few, whether they have even this teeny tiny exemption, if they have a shot at it. So
yeah, one of the things we're thinking about is they could draw the exemption more broadly, but then there wouldn't be any insurance products out there that we could avail ourselves of that would conform to our teaching.
Because the insurers
it's really
would still be held
incredible.
To
this.
Correct. So, and even evangelical colleges, for example, who may have different teachings about contraceptives, they'll be required to provide contraceptives to their unmarried students. And every evangelical I know would be clearly of the mind that students who aren't married ought not be sexually active. And they don't want to provide contraceptives to their students either. It really is a gross disrespect for matters that most Christian folks consider extremely important matters of conscience, not just casual matters, but extremely important matters of conscience, to run roughshod over conscience in this way.
Bishop Laurie mentioned, what was it, the term interim final?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Bishop's right. That's lawyer speak. It sounds oxymoronic, but an interim final regulation, oftentimes regulations only reach that stage. They never go to the final, and they have the force of law. So it's the comment period is over. It's been promulgated. It has the force of law. It may never go to final, but it still would have the force of law. We would like to think that the administration is looking at modifying both the regulation itself and the exemption. This isn't just a matter of the exemption because, as Bishop pointed out, there are entrepreneurs who have small businesses and others and health care providers who have conscience that's violated by this as well.
When will this go into effect?
It goes into effect, I believe, in August of 2012. Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm. It does. It does.
Yeah.
Okay. And as you mentioned, the time for public comment is over. Does this mean that there's not much we as citizens could do about this anymore?
Oh, I think the citizens can do a lot. They need to continue to send comments to the administration and to HHS, and they need to be talking about it. They need to be asking candidates when candidates are speaking, how do they feel about this? They need to be writing about it. Children need to be taught about, you know, this is a good example of how church and state intersect, and we have a wonderful long tradition in the United States of carving out exemptions and also crafting laws that don't do things like this. So,
and I think in what you've just said, Martin, you are describing part of the mission of the Ad Hoc Committee on Religious Liberty. It is really designed to help pastors and people in the pews to not only be educated about things like this, but to give them avenues for speaking out and ways of voicing the displeasure of so many Catholics and so many other people of goodwill against such a real violation of our religious liberty.
And this is clearly an example of something that's not going to touch Catholics only, as you said, Martin. This is going to touch the consciences of many people.
This whole movement is not just about protecting the Catholic Church or giving it special rights. Religious freedom is important at a very fundamental level because it's one of the checks and balances in our American political system. To have an independent church and an independent press is very important for the checks and balances in our society, because if these government policies can closet religion in a variety through a variety of means, some of which we'll be talking about today, and to try to dim or turn down the volume of that voice, who fills that vacuum? Government does. Is it important that we have a vigorous religious voice in America? We just erected a monument to Martin Luther King on the National Mall. That was what a vigorous religious voice looks like, and we need to have laws that promote that. It's also important because church and state need to cooperate for the common good. And so one of the issues that the committee's concerned about is this new strategy that's been adopted to implement specifications and contracts that will have the effect of excluding Catholics, Evangelical Protestants, Orthodox Jews, Mormons, and others from being able to cooperate with government in providing job training. One of the contracts that's had a lot of discussion is the human trafficking contract, and they're adding specifications that tend to be sexual in nature that will foreclose religion from participating in these contracts. That's a very conscious agenda that's been pronounced by the ACLU, the Anti-Defamation League, and others over the years.
The contract regarding religious trafficking and the work that the Catholic Church has done there and now is out of the picture because of the restrictions that have been put on it is something very important I think we need to make sure our listeners know about. But we will do that, if they'll stay with us, after yet another break. Thanks.
The Colorado Catholic Herald is now on Twitter. The Colorado Catholic Herald, your primary source of news and events from around the diocese, is now on the social media platform of Twitter. Get advance notice of upcoming headlines, breaking news, and special event coverage. Our handle is the @ CCH @CCHerald. That's @CCHerald. So join us on Twitter. Now we return to a very special episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents.
We're back with Bishop William Lorry of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and chair of the Catholic Bishops of the United States, their ad hoc committee on religious liberty, as well as with Martin Nussbaum, consultant to that committee, and resident of Colorado Springs. Welcome back to both of you. We're talking about the very important topic of religious liberty, and spent most of our last segment talking about the HHS mandate. But just before we ended that segment, Martin, you sort of moved us into the contracts that we had, the government and the Catholic Church had, in this whole area of human trafficking, which have now gone away. And Bishop Lorry, maybe you're the one that can tell our listeners about that. That was a very unfortunate thing.
We have two very prominent, excellent international relief agencies. One is Migration and Refugee Services. That's directly sponsored by the Bishops' Conference, and it does tremendous work in the whole area of human trafficking. And it's my understanding that HHS then has imposed a new condition for that contract to be renewed, namely that if MRS wished to apply for the renewal of this contract, it had to include the full range of reproductive services in it, and that would include abortion and contraception. In other words, in order to qualify for this contract, you had to become an abortion provider. Obviously, a Catholic organization like MRS could not do that. That was one side. The other one is Catholic Relief Services. Now, Catholic Relief Services is all over the world. It is providing all kinds of emergency relief aid in some of the worst circumstances you can imagine, and also it deals very compassionately with AIDS victims. And they said that in order to qualify for the renewal of certain of those contracts, they would have to be involved in condom distribution. And this came not from HHS, but from the U.S. Agency for International Development. So you can see that the rules got changed, and the rules were changed not by a legislature, not by a court, but by administrative agencies who are just simply doing this without much oversight.
And it wasn't as if these agencies, these Catholic agencies, were doing a bad job. Weren't they considered to be doing one of the very best jobs in helping victims of human trafficking?
Absolutely. If you look at these agencies according to objective measurements for fulfilling the contracts that they had been given, they did a superb job. And internal documents that the Washington Post got a hold of showed how well-rated these two agencies were. They were denied the renewal of their contracts on ideological reasons, on their refusal to violate their consciences. I believe the imposition of these new conditions for the renewal of these contracts is actually illegal, and I testified to that before the Congress.
You know, it's important to see kind of the larger move that's taking place here. It used to be that the secularists attempted to keep faith-based organizations from entering contracts with government to serve needy individuals. And they would oppose that by saying that the language they would use is that the government's subsidizing discrimination if they let the faith-based organizations hire like-minded people of faith. This is a new strategy, and the strategy now will have the same effect if it's successful, which is to get faith-based charitable organizations out of these type of cooperative arrangements with government, and it's to impose sexually defined requirements to the contract that the church can't stomach. And it's another way to drive them out of the business of cooperating with government and put religion in the closet. The other thing to note here is that before the administration issued the new regulations against the USCCB on the human trafficking contract, the ACLU had filed a lawsuit to challenge this contract. They were arguing that it was an establishment of religion, which is a rather strained argument, to say the least. But before that case was even decided, the administration put in place all of the remedies sought by the ACLU. So at the ACLU, it's as if the administration is following orders from the ACLU in this case to drive religion out of the business. And this will affect all sorts of folks. This will affect the Salvation Army. It'll affect groups like World Vision. This isn't just a Catholic thing. Catholic Charities and others have cooperated with government to address the needs of needy individuals, but so have other ministries. And it's a wonderful good in our society to have church and state cooperating to help the needy.
Well, those most... Go ahead, Bishop.
Sorry, it really is. And if you take it down to the local level, I think in most big cities, in most dioceses, Catholic Charities is the largest non-governmental source of charitable and social services. So if you put Catholic Charities essentially out of business, or you simply limit it to whatever charitable donations within a diocese can produce, you are really dismantling a large part of the safety net in the United States for the poor and the needy. And it's unfortunate for a lot of reasons. It's certainly unfortunate because it represents a huge violation of religious liberty, but it's also putting needy, vulnerable people at risk. And it's amazing the lack of compassion, as well as the lack of religious liberty, the lack of appreciation for religious liberty on the part of the people who are doing this.
And you know, that brings us to another strategy that's similar to this that's being used, and Catholic Charities is a good example. So there's some things in society that institutions and individuals can't do unless they're licensed. I'm a lawyer. I can't practice law unless I'm licensed. Government's the gatekeeper for whether I can practice law. It's also the gatekeeper of who gets to place children in adoptive homes. And so Catholic Charities has been the lead, as a lead organization, and some other faith-based organizations have been as well, in placing children in households. And as we've seen now in Boston, in the District of Columbia, in the state of Illinois, and in San Francisco, the rules have been changed there that you can't be licensed unless you agree to place children in same-sex households. And so Catholic Charities, which has placed some of the most difficult children in loving homes, are now being removed from that. How does that help society? I mean, what is the good that's being accomplished? It's simply a secularist agenda to put religion in the closet. And if I may, one more example, please, of this. At Eastern Michigan University, there was a young woman who was going through a master's program to become licensed as a high school counselor so she could work in high school. She had religious scruples against marriage or same-sex unions, and she saw that one of the persons she was to counsel in her clinical rotation was a young man complaining of depression secondary to the breakup of his partnership with his partner. She quietly asked someone who didn't have religious scruples against that if they would counsel that individual. And what happened as a result of that is there was inquiry by her university, and she was eventually expelled from the university. In other words, society is saying in her case, you are unfit to be a high school counselor if you won't agree to treat individuals who make choices regarding to same-sex unions as identical to everyone else with regard to that, even though other counseling was available to that person. So this business of licensing is another way that can be extremely powerful tool to closet religion. This reached the U.S. Supreme Court level in the case called CLS versus Martinez. So it's not quite licensing, but to be a recognized student organization at the Hastings University Law School, you had to be qualified. And if you're qualified, it's like a license. You can then use the bulletin boards in the classrooms and meeting rooms and the internet and so on. The university adopted rules regarding sexual orientation and welcoming folks into your group, regardless what your group was about, regardless of orientation. And a group called the Christian Legal Society that had about 8 students when the lawsuit began said, "We insist that our leaders be following traditional sexual ethics with regard, Christian sexual ethics, with regard to their relationships." They were found unfit to be a member of that academic community. This case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said that Hastings did nothing unconstitutional. I mean, that's really terrifying, frankly, to think in the 100-year history of that law school, one student group was found to be unfit, the Christian Legal Society.
It's amazing.
So the bishops have a lot of work.
We all have.
Well, you do. It is amazing. When I went to testify before the subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, the subcommittee on the Constitution, I could see how much work is ahead of us and what an uphill climb it's going to be. I think mention has already been made of the attack of the Department of Justice on the Defense of Marriage Act, referring to it as an act of bigotry. And as I testified before this subcommittee, many of the questions I got equated our defense of marriage as between a man and a woman with bigotry akin to that of racism, to opposition to interracial couples. And of course, once our teaching is characterized as bigotry, then of course you realize we're going to be in the crosshairs of the state for a long time to come, and a lot of church-state battles ahead.
Now, the Defense of Marriage Act was enacted in the Clinton administration, correct?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. President Clinton signed it into law.
Yeah.
And so the bill has now been attacked as unconstitutional, and the Department of Justice of the current administration has decided not only not to defend the constitutionality of the bill, but to attack its constitutionality. And what's happening there legally is, if there's some type of protected class that's being discriminated against, that's lawyer talk, then the government has to show a compelling governmental interest. But if there's not a protected class, which is the situation here, the government has to show there's no rationality to this law whatsoever. That's why when Bishop Lori says the administration's arguing that it's a matter of bigotry to support traditional marriage, that's the same as saying is there's no rationality. It's irrational, bigoted activity, which is what makes a lot of faith individuals and faith communities are then being deemed bigoted by the Justice Department in this case.
Recently, I wrote to our senators here asking them to support the continuation of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and I got back the stock letters, which everyone does, using the word bigotry. They're not going to be bigots and defend marriage as an institution or a union of one man and one woman. So that's very unfortunate. Bishop Lori and or Martin, what's going to be the fallout from that in terms of, do we have religious exemptions? Go ahead.
The fallout's already showing up. And Martin already mentioned, the licensures of adoption agencies. So our Catholic charities all have adoption programs. We seek to put kids into good homes with a mom and a dad where there's great stability, where there are role models, of how you relate to a man and to a woman, and where there is this bond of love, that is regarded as unacceptable unless we're also willing to place them with same-sex couples. There was in New York State a county clerk who didn't want to participate in same-sex unions. It's legal in New York State. And she got into trouble for her refusal. Marriage and references to marriage are peppered all over federal and state law. Right. If you redefine marriage so that it can be between a man and a woman or between two people of the same sex, you are making huge, far-reaching changes. And, of course, this will affect not only the Catholic Church, but other churches and many other institutions as well. I don't think people realize this.
Absolutely. We're talking with Bishop Laurie and Martin Nussbaum, and we will continue this very important discussion on religious liberty in just a moment.
ColoradoCatholicHerald.com is the website of the award-winning Colorado Catholic Herald newspaper. For the latest Catholic news, both at home and around the world, log on to ColoradoCatholicHerald.com. The Colorado Catholic Herald, bringing the Catholic world to you.
Today's episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents is archived at Colorado Catholic Herald online. Just go to www.ColoradoCatholicHerald.com and click on the audio video link on the left side, and you can listen to every episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents.
Welcome back. We're visiting today with Bishop William Laurie, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Martin Nussbaum, attorney. And the three of us, primarily the two of them, are giving us some very important information on what we see as the growing erosion of religious liberty in our country, actually, not just locally, but in our country as well. And in the few minutes that we have left, I know, Bishop Laurie, during the break, you said you wanted to bring up the Alabama law regarding the kinds of assistance even that could be given to immigrants who are in the state illegally. Bring our listeners up to date on that.
Well, in Alabama, there was recently passed an immigration law that would criminalize Good Samaritan services to the undocumented on the part of even religious communities. And it just, I think this underlines the fact that threats to religious liberty, while they may often be perceived to be on the left-hand side of the political spectrum, can also be on the right as well. Attacking religious liberty can be an equal opportunity enterprise. And so I just want to stress that this is not partisanship we're dealing with. We're trying to defend both what the Constitution protects and what our religious liberty teaching prompts us to understand about the dignity of the human person. So I just want to make it pretty clear that we're not engaging here in partisan politics. We are engaging in seizing our legacy as Americans and our dignity as human persons as understood by the teaching of the Church.
This Alabama immigration law then would make it illegal, for example, for a Catholic priest, a Catholic agency, to in any way help to try to meet the physical, perhaps the spiritual needs of an immigrant who is here illegally. They could be...
So what if you're a pastor and you have, lots of immigrants in your congregation, and some of them are undocumented, and you're helping them at Christmas time, or you're providing them with counseling or whatever. For doing your job as a priest, you could be in the crosshairs of that law. That's very draconian.
It is, and something I think most people would never have believed would have taken place here in our country. Martin, you too during the break brought up the Hosanna Tabor case as something you thought it would be important for our listeners to hear in this context.
Oh my goodness, yes. This is maybe the most important Supreme Court case of my lifetime, except perhaps Roe v. Wade. And it's similar. It's related to the situation in Alabama. So in Alabama, we're talking about a fundamental freedom of churches to minister to individuals, whether they're documented or not. They're children of God in the eyes of the church, right? So the church ministers to children of God, regardless of what documents they have. That's a fundamental freedom to evangelize, to serve, and so on. But so is a fundamental freedom to choose who ministers on your behalf. And this is the constitutional name for this doctrine is called the Doctrine of First Amendment Doctrine of Church Autonomy, and a subset of it is called the Ministerial Exception. So there's a case before the United States Supreme Court that's been argued and briefed, it's not decided yet, called Hosanna Tabor. Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran, or Missouri Synod Lutheran Church and School is the name of the case. The doctrine at issue is that when someone's unhappy with an employer, even a church employer, they can file suit for a variety of reasons: breach of contract, defamation, violation of civil rights laws. When those plaintiff employees have been ministers, our circuit courts in the United States and most of our state Supreme Courts have been consistent in saying that that relationship is so intrinsically religious that we, the civil courts, have no jurisdiction over the dispute, and we're going to defer to the ecclesiastical authorities. This case has now come to the United States Supreme Court involving a teacher in a Lutheran school, and much to everyone's surprise, the current administration intervened as a party in the case, so it's EEOC versus this Lutheran school, not just the plaintiff. And the Assistant Solicitor General, in her briefs and arguments, argue that there is no such freedom, that the ministerial exception does not exist, and she argued that the freedom of the church is no different than the freedom of a labor union to select its members, which prompted a response both from Justice Kagan and Justice Scalia. They were both astonished to hear the argument, and hopefully that's a good sign that the court will be rejecting that argument. But the idea that our government at the highest levels could stand before the U.S. Supreme Court and argue that that freedom doesn't exist is remarkable. That freedom, by the way, is why the Catholic Church can insist that its ordained clergy are men. That's discrimination on the basis of gender, which on its face is prohibited by Title VII. That's why the Greek Orthodox Church could insist that its pastors be of Greek descent, or the African Methodist Episcopal Church could insist that a pastor be of African descent, and so on. So it's a fundamental freedom. It shows how far we've gone as a society that this could even be a question, and again, why there's a great need for the bishops to form the committee to help activate the faithful form coalitions to address these things, interfaith coalitions and so on.
Bishop Laurie, in the time that we have left, and I want you to remind our listeners again of this ad hoc committee of the bishops on religious liberty, which you head and what you're all about.
Well, thank you, Bishop Sheridan. The ad hoc committee, again, it exists to defend religious liberty as understood in our American experiment by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and in our teaching, our church's teaching, our social teaching on the dignity of the human person. It is seeking also to address many of the imminent threats to religious liberty that are underway right now. And we're doing this by education, by helping priests to preach about it, parish pamphlets. We're looking at social media to get the word out. We're looking at scholarly conferences, also looking at public policy, advocating for laws to protect religious liberty, and litigation. That is to say, litigating in certain cases when we know that religious liberty is being violated. The most important thing here, and the goal of the committee really, is to mobilize the laity. What worked in Connecticut when they decided to reorganize our Catholic parishes against church teaching? What really worked was that we had 5,000 people in about 4 or 5 days gathered up on the Capitol steps in Hartford. When the legislators looked out their window and they saw that, they said, "Oh my goodness, we have a problem." I would love to think that my good looks and my reasonable arguments would win the day. But the reality is, this is a moment for Catholics and other faiths and people of goodwill to come together and to form a coalition of mind and heart and will to defend the first of our freedoms, the most fundamental of our freedoms, because this is the one that concerns our relationship to God, the relationship of the human person to God. If that freedom is compromised, so will freedom of speech be compromised, and freedom of assembly, and freedom of the press.
Thank you.
There is a lot at stake here, and I think we have to really get out there and convey the message.
Absolutely. Bishop Laurie Martin, thanks so much. You've taught us a great deal. You've reminded us that we are citizens, we have a voice, and we all need to be part of this protection of religious liberty in our country. I'd like to conclude our program by just offering a blessing to you, Martin, and Bishop Laurie, and to all our listeners. May the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit come upon you and remain with you always. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Bishop. Thank you, Martin.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Join us each week as Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs discusses topics relevant to your life and your faith. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Catholic Radio Network and the Diocese of Colorado Springs. If there is a topic that you'd like to hear covered by Bishop Sheridan Presents, please call the Catholic Radio Network at 970-669-8000. Thanks again for listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents, brought to you by the Colorado Catholic Herald, the official newspaper of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Today's episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents is archived at Colorado Catholic Herald online. Just go to www.coloradocatholicherald.com and click on the audio video link on the left side, and you can listen to every episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents.